Well, hello, everyone. It is time to read the Des Moines Register for this Wednesday, February 21st, 2024. A reminder that all material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Dennis May, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Barb DeHack. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinion, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. And now let's take a look at the weather and the headlines from today's Des Moines Register. Our statewide AccuWeather forecast calls for a mild day today with clouds and sun, winds from the north at 4 to 8 miles per hour, and partly cloudy tonight. The forecast for Des Moines calls for a high today of 62 with a low of 40, mild with times of clouds and sun. And on Thursday, a high of 57 with a low of 32, turning sunny and breezy across the area. Going to be a mild day today. Our Iowa extremes for Tuesday was 67 in Sioux City and 16 in Clarinda. Turning to the front page of today's Des Moines Register, our headlines. New poll says Trump trounces Haley in South Carolina. Also on the front page, low HPV vaccination rates worry officials. And the Iowa Supreme Court says false statements don't invalidate a warrant. And here to get us started with today's Des Moines Register is Barb.
Thank you, Dennis. A new poll says Trump trounces Haley in South Carolina. Donald Trump is poised to trounce Nikki Haley on Saturday in her home state of South Carolina, an exclusive Suffolk University USA Today poll finds. With a yawning advantage that hasn't been diminished by the former president's controversy or legal travails. Among those very likely to vote in the state's Republican primary, Trump leads Haley by close to 2-1, 63% to 35%. Quote, the story of this poll is the depth of strength shown by Trump, said David Paleologos, director of the Suffolk University Political Research Center. The former president holds double-digit advantages among men and women in every age group and among both high school graduates and those with a college degree. Haley has hoped for a strong showing in South Carolina, the state that twice elected her governor. But Paleologos notes that Trump's current lead is larger than his 19-point win in 2016 over Senator Marco Rubio in the state's home state of Florida. At the time, Trump wasn't a resident of Florida, where he declared residency in 2019. The survey was taken Thursday through Sunday by landline and cell phone of 500 South Carolina voters who said they were very likely to vote in the primary or had already cast an early ballot. The margin of sampling error is 4.4 percentage points. Trump created controversy this month when he mocked Haley's husband, Major Michael Haley, a National Guardsman now on a year-long deployment to Africa. Quote, what happened to her husband? Where is he? He asked, suggestively at a rally in Conway, South Carolina. He's gone. Haley responded on social media, Michael is deployed, serving our country, something you know nothing about. Even so, Trump leads Haley among voters in military families by 65% to 33%. A bit wider than his standing among those who don't have a member of the military in their family. While both Trump and Haley have net favorable ratings among primary voters, the former president is more popular, 64% to 25%, than the former governor is, 47% to 36%. Trump is also more likely to convert a favorable opinion into a primary vote. 90% of those with a positive view of him plan to cast their ballot for the former president. In comparison, 65% of those with a favorable opinion of Haley plan to vote for her. Haley does hold a wide lead among those who identify themselves as liberals or moderates, 59% to 38%, and a narrow one among those who are voting in the GOP primary for the first time, at 51% to 49%. Her biggest advantage over Trump, 63% to 37%, is among those who say the most important issue is the future of democracy. That said, only 13% of those surveyed say democracy is their biggest concern. Ranked at the top, at 42%, is immigration and border security. Those voters support Trump by nearly 4-1.
Turning to our second article, low HPV vaccination rates worry officials. Almost half of Iowa's teens haven't had shots. Nearly two decades since the vaccine against HPV first arrived in Iowa, local health officials in parts of the state say they still struggle to persuade residents to vaccinate their children. In 2023, about 56% of the state's 13 to 15-year-olds were fully vaccinated against the human papillomavirus, a sexually transmitted infection that is linked to deadly cancers. That includes certain types of cancers that are prevalent in Iowa. The new data from the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services shows last year's immunization rates are in line with recent years. The HPV vaccination rate among adolescent Iowans had fallen slightly from 57% in 2022 and from nearly 58% in 2021 and nearly 59% in 2020. However, the state's public health data paints a starker picture in portions of southeast and eastern Iowa, where the HPV immunization rate falls below 30%. Local public health officials in those areas say they have long struggled to make progress on the vaccination rate, pointing to stigma and misinformation about the vaccine as significant factors. Health experts warn HPV can spread easily in areas with low immunization rates, which in turn increases the risk for nearby counties, even those with higher vaccine uptake. That's an alarming possibility for health experts, who say a lack of protection against HPV increases the risk that more Iowans could be exposed to deadly cancer-causing viral strains. Down the road, those cancers lead to a lot of deaths, and they're going to lead to a lot of deaths of Iowans. Anything we can do to increase those vaccination rates is important, said Nathan Boonstra, a Des Moines-based pediatrician and chair of the Iowa Immunizes Coalition. So why do some Iowa counties have lower vaccination rates? Well, Van Buren County had the lowest HPV immunization rate in Iowa last year, with just 23% of its 13 to 15-year-olds fully vaccinated. That's a drop from 37.5% in 2020. In our county, it has been well accepted, said Lindy Thomas, public health administrator for Van Buren County. Thomas said the county has a large Amish and Mennonite population who have universally turned down the shots for their children. But even outside that population, parents typically decline the two-series vaccines, saying they believe their children aren't old enough for a vaccine that protects against sexually transmitted virus. It's been a conversation for years, Thomas said. We've always had issues with that one. When it first came out, I think it was promoted as more of a sexual vaccine instead of a cancer-preventing vaccine, and I think that has stuck with that vaccine. The vaccine is recommended to girls and boys at 11 and 12 years to prevent serious health problems caused by HPV, which is the most common sexually transmitted infection in the United States. While most infections clear up on their own, HPV infections, in some cases, can cause certain types of cancer, including cervical, vulvar, vaginal, anal, penile, and oropharyngeal, or throat. It inherently gets stigmatized, Boonstra said. That's really too bad, because most people who are sexually active in their lives will contract at least one type of HPV. That's pretty universal. Boonstra said the vaccine is recommended to adolescents because the shots have been found to be more effective against HPV infection if the vaccine is administered before that individual is exposed to the virus. The 2024 Cancer in Iowa report by the University of Iowa states Iowa ranks second in the nation for the highest rate of new cases of oral cavity and pharyngeal cancer. Researchers at UI pointed to alcohol consumption as a leading contributing factor, but other studies have shown HPV is one of the leading causes of cancer in the throat, particularly among men. In fact, HPV-related cancers kill more people every year than polio, measles, tetanus, and chickenpox combined, before vaccines for these diseases were developed, state public health officials say. Michelle Cullen, public health manager for Jackson and Clinton counties, said Jackson County lacks many primary health care providers that can offer the immunization. She believes that is a major contributing factor in other rural counties, too. To encourage residents to seek out the shots, Cullen said her public health staff have tried multiple ways to raise awareness about the importance of these shots. They send students home with packets of information for their parents. Their nurses adjust hours at the county immunization clinic to expand appointment hours. Despite all this, Jackson County's immunization rate among its 13 to 15-year-olds is just 26% in 2023, one of the lowest rates in the state. That compares to 31% in 2020. Clinton County's immunization rate was nearly 37% in 2023. We've done outreach, we've done awareness and education, but we have not seemed to move the needle very much, Cullen said. HPV shots are a frequent target of anti-vaccine legislation. Since the HPV vaccine was first recommended by federal health officials in 2006, infections of HPV strains that cause cancers and genital warts have fallen 88% among teen girls and 81% among young adult women, according to the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention. HPV vaccine is one of the most life-saving vaccines that we have, Boonstra said. It is demonstrated to drastically reduce certain kinds of cancers, especially cervical cancer, but also head and neck cancers. But because of the stigma and because of its relatively new vaccine, Boonstra said HPV has been an easy target for anti-vaccine movements that have eroded confidence in the shots. In recent years, several bills have been introduced to the Iowa legislature that raise concerns to public health advocates like those in the Iowa Immunizes Coalition. That includes a bill being considered by lawmakers this session that would revoke a minor's right to consent to HPV vaccine. Senate File 2064 passed a committee vote last week, making it eligible for Senate debate. Boonstra said if the bill did go into effect, that provision likely wouldn't affect immunization rates in Iowa. Still, he said such legislation could chip away at the margins. Quote, I really do think that our legislators know that vaccines are important, Boonstra said. I think they know that HPV vaccine is important. Some may need to learn more about the importance of adolescents being able to make some of their health care decisions as they reach a certain age. The Iowa Immunizes Coalition continues to watch this type of legislation closely and other factors that could impact Iowa's immunization rate. Quote, we want kids to grow up healthy, Boonstra said. We want to reduce the risk of cancer as much as possible. And an adolescent who doesn't have that vaccine is going to be at a higher risk of a number of cancers.
The Iowa Supreme Court rules that false statements don't invalidate a warrant. How many times can a police officer be wrong, or flat out dishonest, on a warrant application before the resulting warrant is invalid? Quite a few, according to a divided Iowa Supreme Court. In a 4-3 ruling, the court on Friday reversed a decision suppressing evidence against Jesse Harbach, who was charged with operating while intoxicated after rolling his car in 2021 near Delhi. Delaware County Deputy Mitch Knipper, who investigated the crash, subsequently filed an application for a warrant to draw blood from Harbach, stating that Harbach refused to take a preliminary breath or field sobriety test, had bloodshot and watery eyes, slurred and mumbled his speech, and smelled of alcohol. The only problem, according to the judge handling Harbach's case, was that none of that was true. Knipper's body camera footage did not show Harbach's had slurred speech or bloodshot eyes, and given that a later blood draw found no alcohol in Harbach's system, the court questioned how Knipper could have smelled it on his breath. The blood draw did detect methamphetamine, for which Harbach was charged. As for field sobriety and breathalyzer testing, the videos showed Knipper didn't ask Harbach to undergo either. In fact, as an earlier Iowa Court of Appeals decision noted, Knipper did not, in his warrant application, Harbach was strapped to a backboard and neck brace in an ambulance, being treated by emergency responders when Knipper spoke to him. Finding that the application would not have supported probable cause without the false statements, the judge suppressed the Moore results, and the Court of Appeals affirmed. Supreme Court Justice Dana Oxley, joined by Justices David May and Christopher McDonald, and Chief Justice Susan Christensen, said that's not how courts should view warrant charges, and that later courts should not take a grudging or negative attitude toward the probable cause finding of the magistrate who approved the warrant. When officers seek a warrant, it's not enough that a statement be incorrect, Oxley wrote, because the defendant must show that the officer was intentionally or recklessly misleading. The majority found Harbaugh failed to present any such evidence. The justices also took issue with the trial judge's factual findings. Oxley wrote that the video was not so clear or the angle so direct to conclusively see the state of Harbaugh's eyes, nor was the audio clarity good enough to say definitely he was not slurring his words. And while the blood test 3 hours after the crash detected no alcohol, an earlier hospital procedure detected ethanol in Harbaugh. Oxley wrote to the majority, wrote that the majority, quote, takes judicial notice, end quote, that this finding indicates some alcohol in Harbaugh's blood, and thus supports the deputy's claim to have smelled alcohol at the scene. The decision did not set aside Nipper's claim that Harbaugh refused field sobriety and breathalyzer testing, but found that the remaining challenged statements were enough to support probable cause and overturned the suppression ruling. Justice Tom Waterman, joined by Justices Edward Mansfield and Matthew McDermott, wrote that he would have affirmed the decision to throw out the warrant. Waterman agreed with the lower courts that the video did not support Nipper's claims and that Nipper made misstatements intentionally or recklessly on the warrant application. Moreover, he wrote, the majority chose to give Nipper the benefit of the doubt on every disputed fact, despite other examples where the deputy was clearly in the wrong. After the video affirmatively showed that the deputy lied about Harbaugh refusing breath and sobriety tests and about Harbaugh refusing to answer any questions, why believe the rest of his claims? Waterman asked. Do you eat more stew after finding a rancid piece of meat? Waterman also knocked the majority for accepting the ethanol test result without any testimony about its significance, and mourned the decision will undermine defendants' rights established by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1978. Pardon me, to challenge warrants obtained through false statements. Delaware County Sheriff John LeClaire did not respond to a message asking about the decision and whether his office had any concerns with how Nipper handled Harbaugh's investigation. Attorney Maria Rutenberg, representing Harbaugh, told the Des Moines Register she was disappointed in the decision, but noted that Harbaugh has not been convicted of any crime and will still be able to contest his charge in court.
Turning over now to the Metro and Iowa section, our headlines. Lawmakers exploring options for tax cuts. Shooting suspect granted a new trial. A question, will warm weather affect ice skating in Des Moines? And the Iowa Senate passes a bill that would allow state agencies to outsource their annual audits. We'll start with the lawmakers are exploring options for tax cuts. Reynolds' proposed package includes a 3.65% flat tax. Republican lawmakers began advancing Governor Kim Reynolds' plan to further reduce Iowa income tax rates Monday, but the Senate tax writing chair said he was exploring a range of options in the coming weeks as lawmakers decide how to approach cuts. Reynolds, seeking to build on three prior cuts under her administration, has proposed accelerating a series of gradual reductions to bring Iowa's rate down to a flat tax of 3.65% in 2024. Her tax package would also cut the unemployment tax rates for businesses and change how child care facilities would be taxed. The bill incorporating all of those changes was advanced Monday by a Senate subcommittee. But Senator Dan Dawson, Republican from Council Bluffs, said he wanted to see details and get further input as the session continues. Quote, I think we have some pretty large plans out there, Dawson said, and there's plans that ultimately want to return money back to the taxpayers but have very different ways of doing it. Right now, these are all just pieces of paper people are talking about, Dawson told reporters. I think it's important to kind of get the fiscal notes and give Iowans an opportunity to weigh in and say, what is the vision for these monies out there? Reynolds and Republicans aiming to further cut taxes argue that Iowa's current budget surplus warrants returning money to taxpayers. Democrats warn that cuts would overwhelmingly benefit wealthy Iowans while giving the state less financial wiggle room if the U.S. economy takes a downturn. Dawson, alongside the House Tax Writing Chair, has introduced his own tax plan aimed at eventually eliminating Iowa's individual income tax entirely. He called the bill, quote, a starting point for coming years when he introduced the plan, Senate Study Bill 3141, on February 1st. On Monday, he also introduced two new bills splitting up parts of Reynolds' plan that would drop businesses' top tax rate for unemployment taxes to 5.4%. That's Senate Study Bill 3182, and taxing child care facilities as residential properties, lowering their property tax burden. That's Senate Study Bill 3181. What Iowa business groups say, what do they say about Reynolds' tax cut plan? Well, a range of business groups told lawmakers Monday that they were encouraged by efforts to further reduce taxes. This is what helps our small businesses most, said Matt Everson with the Iowa's chapter of National Federation of Independent Business. It's letting them keep their own money and letting them invest how they see fit. A couple of lobbyists voiced caution about further cuts. Peter Hurd, with Iowa Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO, warned that the proposed changes could hurt the state financially if the economy turned gloomy. Our concern is that this fund does start to head downwards in the next couple of years while times are good. We won't be solvent for when times are bad, Hurd said. Several groups spoke in favor of the plan to change child care facilities tax designations, citing a need for additional care options across the state. Senate Minority Leader Pam Yoakum, Democrat from Dubuque, said the Republican-led plans would bring relief to Iowans that most need a tax change. The tax bills that we have seen so far clearly benefit the wealthiest of Iowans, Yoakum said. She argued that Iowa needed to invest the budget surplus into quality of life issues to attract new workers and retain existing ones. And though Democrats in both chambers have prioritized expanding access to affordable child care, Yoakum cautioned that changing their tax designation may not be the best avenue to do so, instead suggesting that legislators address wages for child care workers. Many of them are still earning maybe $10 an hour, and they're having a harder time filling the ranks of who's providing the care for our children than they are for the location itself, Yoakum said.
The Iowa Senate passes a bill that would allow state agencies to outsource their annual audits. The Iowa Senate has voted to allow state agencies to outsource their annual audits, passing a Republican-led bill that would create private sector competition for the Democrat-held state auditor's office. Senate File 2311, which passed on a 31-16 party-line vote Monday, would allow Iowa departments to hire a private, nonpartisan, certified public accountant to perform their annual audit. Those audits are now conducted by the Office of State Auditor Robert Sand. The bill sponsor, Senator Mike Bussolo, Republican of Ankeny, called it an attempt to create public innovation and foster good government, responding on the floor to criticisms that the bill undermines the only Democrat holding statewide office in Iowa. Only in politics can the hiring of an independent, nonpartisan, certified public accountant be accused of being political, Bussolo said. Bussolo said the auditor's office and firms across Iowa have struggled to recruit and hire certified CPAs, arguing that the bill would address a short-staffed field while granting state agencies the same option as local governments. Democrats slammed the bill as a political ploy to kneecap Sand's authority as auditor. This isn't the first attempt to try and diminish the state auditor, said Senator Tony Bisignano, Democrat of Des Moines, referring to a law passed last year curbing Sand's investigative powers. This is a cheaper attempt, in my opinion. He called the Republican efforts paranoia and suspicious, accusing them of seeking to hold oversight into GOP-led state government. You've got to concoct this entire story today to tell us that this is critical, Pizzignano said. What's the hurry? Busolo pushed back on those concerns by pointing to the Iowa Finance Authority's hiring of independent auditors without corruption or fraud. Sand, in a news conference last week, said the legislation was not to create a better system for taxpayers. It's to undermine the independently elected official of the state of Iowa and for all people who work in this office for taxpayers, Sand said. Lawmakers, as well as Sand's office, have disagreed on what role the auditor's office would have in overseeing state audits conducted by outside auditor. Busolo has said under the bill, the auditor's office would have the power to re-review those audits. Sand's chief of staff, John McCarmelly, said last week that was simply not true. Pizzignano said the office would have just one duty, to file the audit. In his comment on the state on the Senate floor Monday, Busolo said constituents who work in state government are paying more for that audit than they do private CPAs. But according to analysis of the bill from the state's Legislative Services Agency, audits performed by the state auditor's office cost less than the market rate for private firms. Over the last 3 years, the auditor's office has charged a rate of $85 per hour, costing an average of $5.3 million annually. Reports filed to the auditor's office range from $95 to $183 per hour for small cities. Other audits of state entities from outside firms have cost up to $260 per hour. It's difficult to know how much more private audits would cost the state in total if the bill becomes law, because it would depend on how many agencies commission outside audits. The bill now heads to the House.
Will warm weather affect ice skating in Des Moines? Outdoor rink, which had late start in November, aims to stay open until March 20th. February's warmer weather has left Iowans shrugging off parkas, but has it prevented them from lacing up their ice skates? Des Moines could be on track for one of the warmest Februarys on record, according to the National Weather Service. The milder winter weather has already affected the East Village outdoor ice skating facility, Brenton Skating Plaza, which delayed its opening for 12 days due to warmer temperatures in November of last year, said Anthony Leo, Parks and Recreation Supervisor. In addition, the rink closed 2 other days due to warm weather this season. The goal is for the skating rink to remain open until at least March 20th, Leo told the Register. Whether the skating park will have to close sooner due to the weather is something that can only be determined on a day-to-day basis, he said. The weather hasn't seemed to affect patronage, though. It's been busier this year than the previous 2 years, Leo said. That may be due to Brenton Skating Plaza turning to open skating this season as opposed to scheduled ice skating sessions, he said. Other factors can impact the ice skating rink beyond temperature, but the general guideline regarding temperatures and when the skating plaza may have to close says that when it's 55 to 59 degrees, it's open at sundown. When it's 60 to 65 degrees, it's closed for the day. Over 65 degrees, it's closed until ice has recovered. But it's also been bone-chilling cold in Iowa this winter. Des Moines saw the second most snowfall on record in January, complete with sub-zero temperatures. That impacted when Brenton Skating Plaza could operate. When temperatures are under 5 degrees or the wind chill is below 0 degrees, Brenton Skating Plaza will close. Another factor is the sun. Leo said there's a, quote, big difference between 50 degrees and direct sun and 50 degrees and overcast day. The outdoor ice skating facility is open from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. on Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday, and 5 p.m. to 11 p.m. on Friday, and 12 p.m. to 11 p.m. on Saturday, and Sunday at 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Brenton Skating Plaza is closed on Wednesday. So what are ticket prices? Well, ticket prices are $6 for children that are 6 through 12 and adults 60 and up. Tickets are $10 for people 13 and up, and admission is free for children 5 and under. How can you stay up to date on the closures? Well, you can visit dsm.city for the page on Brenton Skating Plaza to find information about the ice skating facility. You can also check on Des Moines Parks and Recreation social media, Facebook and Instagram, for updates. Or you can text Brenton Skating to 84483 for weather cancellation alerts.
shooting suspect is granted a new trial. A Polk County man convicted of murder will get a new trial after the judge in his case conceded he got a key evidentiary ruling wrong. Andrew Harris was found guilty in November of the 2022 shooting death of 38-year-old Terrell Lavelle Grimes outside a bar and restaurant on University Avenue in the Drake University Dogtown District. Prosecutor said Harris, 44, was upset after he and Grimes had a disagreement in the bar and came back 8 minutes later with a gun. Harris's attorney, Huggard, argued at a trial that the shooting was justified, saying Grimes had threatened Harris and that Harris had come back to try to smooth things over, only to see Grimes pulling out what he thought was a gun. Police did not find a gun on Grimes, although Harris's attorneys argued his associates had ample time to conceal the weapon before the police arrived. The jury in November heard that Harris felt threatened by Grimes, but not the exact words that Harris alleges Grimes said. That's because Judge Lawrence McClellan ruled the statement was hearsay and not permissible as evidence. In a ruling Friday, on a motion by Harris' attorney for a new trial, McClellan said that was a mistake. Out-of-court statements are admissible as evidence to explain a listener's reaction or response, including, in this case, Harris's alleged fear for his life. While there was testimony from the defendant regarding the defendant's perceived threat posed by Grimes, the jury did not hear the statements that Grimes allegedly made to him, McClellan wrote. They did not know why the defendant felt Grimes was threatening or how he threatened him. Thus, the jury did not have this evidence to assist in their determination whether the defendant's actions were justified. McClellan accordingly granted Harris's motion, setting the date for April 22nd, but he rejected an alternate argument offered by Harris' attorneys that the jury's verdict was contrary to the weight of the evidence. The greater weight of the evidence supported the finding that the defendant acted willfully, deliberately, and with premeditation or malice aforethought, McClellan wrote. Harris' attorneys declined to comment on the decision.
Top brass in Des Moines Police Department to get pay raises. Another round of pay raises are on the horizon for most of Des Moines' top police officials, as well as other unionized city employees. Members of the Des Moines Police Gold Braid Organization, a union that represents about half of the highest-ranking officials in the police department, will get 4% across-the-board increases to base wages after the City Council voted to approve a new contract Monday. Other benefits for these employees include increases in sick leave hours eligible for payout and employee health insurance contributions. While the contract is laid out specifically with union employees, the new raise and benefits will apply to all 79 Des Moines Police Department leadership staff, which includes sergeants, lieutenants, and captains, according to Des Moines Director of Human Resources James Wells. This means the suggested salary boost for these staff members could cost the city an additional estimated $440,000 in the next fiscal year, which starts July 1st, Wells said. The amount would be covered by the police department's budget. The department makes up the largest portion, or 35% of about $78 million this fiscal year, of the city's operating budget. Gold Braid union members got a 3.5% wage increase in 2021 and a 4% increase in 2019, according to city officials. Additionally, union members working for the Des Moines Municipal Housing Agency, which provides public housing rental units for low-income families and oversees the Section 8 Rental Assistance Program for Polk County, also will get 3% raises, according to a council document. The cost of these raises could total $55,000. The raises will take effect July 1st. So what are the benefits of the latest contract with the Gold Braid Organization? Here are some of the benefits approved for the police sergeants, lieutenants, and captains represented by the Gold Braid Organization in the new one-year contract. Sick leave hours eligible for payout in cash are at separation increased to a maximum of 50% of 2,000 hours from a maximum of 50% of 1,500 hours. A new sick leave insurance plan that allows employees to use all or part of their sick leave balance to pay for retiree health insurance plans through the city until they're eligible for Medicare. A 1 percentage point increase from 11 to 12% in the employees' health insurance contributions. a $350 increase in annual tuition reimbursement, bringing the amount to $2,750 per year. Doubling the amount employees can allocate to replace personal items damaged in the line of duty to $400. A $200 increase in clothing allowance, bringing the amount to $800 per year. The city's agreement with the AFSCME Council 61 Local 3673 union members provides a 3% wage increase in the last year of a 5-year collective bargaining agreement. The union represents 25 full-time staff in the city's public housing authority, including case managers, inspectors, maintenance workers, administrative support, and accounting, according to the council documents. The first 3 years of the agreement, which began July 1st of 2020, included an annual across-the-board wage increase of 2.25% and 3% for the fourth year, council documents show. The fifth year runs from July 1st, 2024 through June 30th of 2025 and affects the city's fiscal year 2025 budget.
When does spring break start? Here's a list of school schedules. Spring is around the corner, which means that students, and perhaps some teachers and professors, are waiting to take a week-long break from school, raising the question, when does spring break start? When are Des Moines area schools on spring break? College students aren't the only ones who get to enjoy spring break. Elementary through high school students are waiting to take a small break from school. Here's a list of spring break schedules for students in Iowa. Spring break will be March 8th to March 15th for the Ankeny Community School District and the Urbandale Community School District, and from March 11th to March 15th for the Des Moines Public Schools, Johnston Community School District, Southeast Polk Community School District, and the West Des Moines Community School District. When will colleges and universities in Iowa have spring break? With just a couple of weeks to go until spring break, college students are counting down the days to take a break from studying and are probably looking for some cheap flights for their next trip. Here are the spring break dates for colleges in Iowa. Spring break will be from March 11th to March 16th for the Des Moines Area Community College, March 11th to March 15th for Drake University, Central College, Grandview University, and the University of Iowa, and the, University of Iowa, let me try that again. March 11th to March 16th for Des Moines Area Community College, March 11th to March 15th for Drake University and Central College, also Grandview University, Iowa State University, and the University of Northern Iowa, while the University of Iowa will have spring break from March 10th to March 17th. Staff of the Nebraska Zoo removes 17 coins from an alligator's stomach. Coin tossing is often associated with good luck or wishes, but for zoo officials in Nebraska, it means unnecessary problems for its residents after finding more than 70 coins in an alligator's stomach. Workers at the Henry Dorley Zoo in Omaha found metal objects in the stomach of 36-year-old resident Thibodeau, a Lucidic American alligator, during a routine exam. Thibodeau, known for its rare white color, underwent a procedure where veterinarians found about 70 U.S. coins in the gator's stomach on Thursday, zoo officials said on a social media post. Christina Plug, an associate veterinarian at the zoo who led the procedure, said the alligator was anesthetized and intubated to remove the coins. A plastic pipe was placed to protect his mouth and safely pass the tools used to access the coins, such as a camera that helped us guide the retrieval of those objects, Pook said. An X-ray image confirmed that all of the coins were successfully removed from Thibodeau's stomach, the post said. The alligator has been released back to his habitat in the zoo. Though a procedure like the one done on Thibodeau is not always common, it's a great example of what our animal care and animal health teams do every day across our campus to provide excellent care to our animals, said Taylor Yaw, zoo veterinarian and director of animal health, said in the release. The zoo is asking visitors not to throw coins in any bodies of water in the zoo, but to instead go to machines located around the park that will turn any loose change into a souvenir coin.
Iowa woman charged with killing husband in Truro in 2021. A wife was arrested for allegedly shooting and killing her husband in northern Iowa nearly 3 years ago. Ryan Cooper of Trier was found dead in his home on June 2021, but at the time, there were no suspects and no one was taken into custody. Investigators at the time described the shooting, quote, as a violent death. Ryan Cooper sustained 2 gunshots to the face and was pronounced dead at the scene. His wife, Karina Cooper, age 46, was arrested for her role in the death of her husband on Monday, according to a news release from the Iowa Department of Public Safety. She is charged with first-degree murder and is being held in the Tama County Jail. While the investigation ensued, Karina Cooper allegedly had told 2 witnesses that she wanted Ryan Cooper dead and could shoot him in the face, according to court documents. According to the release, the investigation is still ongoing, and anyone with information related to the case is urged to contact the Tama County Sheriff's Office or the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. Turning to some national news, 2 charged with murder in Chiefs Parade shooting. 2 men have been charged with murder and other crimes in connection with a shooting at the Kansas City Chiefs Super Bowl victory parade that left 1 person dead and 22 injured, Missouri prosecutors said Tuesday. Dominic M. Miller and Lydell Mays each face charges including second-degree murder, 2 counts of armed criminal action, and unlawful use of a weapon. Miller and Mays are being held on $1 million bond each, according to a statement from the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office. The shooting began at around 2 p.m. on February 14th in a crowd of more than 1 million people gathered for the celebration in front of the Kansas City's Union Station. Some hurt were as young as 8. Mays was in a verbal argument with another person with whom he had no prior connection, Jackson County Prosecutor Gene Peters Baker said at a news conference Tuesday. The argument very quickly escalated, and Mays drew his handgun. Almost immediately, other people pulled out handguns, too, including Miller. Baker said Miller's firearm shot the bullets that killed Lisa Lopez Galvin, a mother of 2 and local radio host. She said Lopez Galvin's family chose not to be at Tuesday's news conference as they focus on the memorial. It is reassuring for our family and the entire community to know that this joint effort resulted in the identification of the suspects involved, the family said in a statement released by the prosecutor's office. Though it does not bring back our beloved Lisa, it is comforting to know that the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office and the Kansas City Police Department made it a top priority to seek justice for Lisa, the other shooting victims, and those who had to witness this tragedy. The new charges come after 2 juveniles were charged with gun-related and resisting arrest charges and held in the Jackson County Juvenile Detention Center last week. Baker said the investigation is still ongoing, and these prosecutors seek to hold every shooter accountable for their actions on that day, every single one.
Navalny's mother appeals to Putin to release his body. The mother of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny appealed Tuesday to President Vladimir Putin to intervene and turn her son's body over to her so she can bury him with dignity. Lyudmila Novolaya, who has been trying to get his body since Saturday, appeared in a video outside the Arctic penal colony where Navalny died on Friday. For the 5th day, I have been unable to see him. They wouldn't release his body to me. And they're not even telling me where he is, a black-clad Novolaya said in the video, with a barbed wire of penal colony number 3 in Karp, about 1,200 miles northeast of Moscow. I'm reaching out to you, Vladimir Putin. The resolution of this matter depends solely on you. Let me finally see my son. I demand that Alexei's body be released immediately so that I can bury him like a human being, she said in the video, which is posted to social media by Navalny's team. Russian authorities have said the cause of Navalny's death is still unknown and refuse to release the body for the next 2 weeks as preliminary inquest continues, members of his team said. They accuse the government of stalling to try to hide evidence. On Monday, Navalny's widow, Yulia, released a video accusing Putin of killing her husband and alleged the refusal to release his body was part of the cover-up. They are cowardly and meanly hiding his body, refusing it to give it up to his mother, and lying miserably, she said. Lyudmila Novolaya said her son's lawyers went to the law enforcement agencies and the morgue where the body is believed to be held in the Arctic region, but were unable to get them to turn it over or to say where it is. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov rejected the allegations of a cover-up, telling reporters that these are absolutely unfounded, insolent accusations about the head of the Russian state. Putin hasn't commented publicly on Navalny's death. On Monday, he signed a decree promoting a number of law enforcement and military officials, including Valery Bolyarov, the first deputy chief of the state penitentiary service. Bolyarov, who received the rank of colonel general, has been accused by Navalny's team of personally ordering restrictions on the opposition leader. Peskov denied there was any connection between Navalny's death and the new rank for Bolyarov. Navalny's death has deprived the Russian opposition of its best-known and inspiring politician. Less than a month before an election that is all but certain to give Putin another 6 years in power. Many Russians had seen Navalny as a rare hope for political change amid Putin's unrelenting crackdown on the opposition. In her Monday video, Yulia Navalnaya vowed to continue his fight against the Kremlin. On Tuesday, her account on X, where she had posted the video, was briefly suspended by the platform without explanation, but later restored. In a speech Monday to the European Union's Foreign Affairs Council, she urged EU leaders not to recognize the results of the next month's election. And Biden says he'll hit Russia with major sanctions. The Biden administration will impose major sanctions on Russia, the White House said Tuesday, in response to the death of Alexei Navalny, a critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin, who died in prison last week under mysterious circumstances. John Kirby, the White House's National Security Communications Advisor, said the new sanctions are designed to hold Russia accountable for what happened to Mr. Navalny, as well as all its actions over the course of this vicious and brutal war that has raged in Ukraine for 2 years. President Joe Biden plans to unveil the sanctions package Friday, Kirby said. He declined to elaborate on what the new sanctions could look like or explain how they might differ from previous U.S. sanctions targeting Russia. After Putin invaded Ukraine in 2022, the Biden administration hit Russia with a range of economic sanctions that blocked major Russian financial institutions from Western financing, banned the U.S. import of all Russian energy products, and penalized wealthy Russian oligarchs tied to Putin, among a host of other actions. Although Biden immediately pinned responsibility on Putin, the U.S. has still not determined how Navalny, 47, died while in custody in an Arctic Circle maximum security prison. We would all love to know what happened here, Kirby said. Regardless of the actual scientific answer, Mr. Putin is responsible for it. The White House called out the Republican-controlled House of Representatives for a two-week recess without approving $60 billion in security assistance for Ukraine. Kirby called passing the funding package one of the most powerful things that we can do right now to stand up to Vladimir Putin. Kirby blamed Ukraine's retreat from the town of Avdiivka, which was taken over by Russian forces over the weekend, on a lack of arms and ammunition as a result of Congress' failure to approve the aid. It was because of congressional inaction, Kirby said. We've been warning Congress that if they didn't act, Ukraine would suffer losses on the battlefield. And here you go. That's what happened this weekend, and that's what's at stake here.
Colorado dorm shooting suspect was roommate of victim. The 25-year-old student arrested on murder charges in the shooting at the University of Colorado campus in Colorado Springs was rooming with one of the two victims, authorities said Tuesday. Nicholas Jordan of Detroit was taken into custody Monday on two counts of first-degree murder in connection with the shooting that killed Samuel Knopp, a 24-year-old student at the university, and Celie Rain Montgomery, 26, who was not enrolled in the school. Their bodies were found in an on-campus dormitory on Friday after shots were reported. Jordan and Knopp were roommates. Ira Cronin, spokesperson for the Colorado Springs Police Department, confirmed to USA Today. Other aspects of their relationship are tied to our ongoing investigation, and we won't be revealing that at this time, Cronin said. Police have said that the shooting was isolated and that Jordan knew Knopp and Montgomery. Jordan was set to appear in court Tuesday. Officers with the campus police department were called to Cruststone House, an on-campus dormitory, after shots were heard at around 6 a.m. Friday. Inside a dorm room, officers found two bodies, triggering an hours-long campus lockdown. At the request of the university police, the Colorado Springs Police Department took over the investigation. By Friday night, officers had Jordan's name and obtained a warrant. This incident does not appear to be a murder-suicide, and both deaths are being investigated as homicides, the city police said Friday in a post on X. On Sunday afternoon, the department publicly identified Canope and Montgomery and said, "Investigative efforts so far continue to indicate this is an isolated incident between parties that were known to one another and not a random attack against the school or other students at the university." Police and officers from the Motor Vehicle Theft Unit spotted Jordan in a car less than 3 miles from campus on Monday morning and arrested him without incident shortly afterwards. Jordan was being held in the El Paso County Jail on a $1 million bond as of Tuesday morning, according to the county jail website. The university was closed over the weekend and classes were canceled Monday, though dozens of people gathered for a memorial walk at the school of more than 11,000 students and nearly 2,000 faculty and staff. "As we mourn the loss of Samuel Canope and Celie Montgomery, my hope is that we will come together as a community, support one another, and share in our grief. Please remember that you are not alone," Chancellor Jennifer Sabonnet wrote in an email to students. Sabonnet described Canope as an accomplished guitar player and an extremely talented musician who was a beloved member of the visual and performing arts department. "Although Montgomery was not a student, she will be mourned by our campus community," Sabonnet said.
The Biden cap raises a robust $42 million in January. President Joe Biden's re-election campaign and Democratic allies raised $42 million in January, giving the incumbent president $130 million in the bank for the 2024 campaign, significantly outpacing his likely Republican opponent, Donald Trump. The $130 million cash on hand, which also includes money from affiliated fundraising committees and the Democratic National Committee, is the most ever for a Democratic presidential candidate at this point in the election cycle. January marked Biden's third straight strongest fundraising month, according to the campaign. The Biden campaign, lacking a formidable Democratic challenger, has been able to save its resources for the general election, while the Trump campaign and related committees have spent heavily to fend off Republican rivals in the GOP primary and to pay for legal fees in Trump's several court cases. This haul will go directly to reaching the voters who will decide this election, said T.J. Duclo, the Biden campaign's senior communications advisor. "That's the reason, number 355 million, that we are confident President Biden and Vice President Harris will win this November," he said, taking a jab at the $355 million a New York judge ordered Trump to pay for fraudulently overvaluing his real estate empire. The Trump campaign has not released its January fundraising figures. Trump's main fundraising committee had $33 million on hand at the start of the year, compared with $46 million for the Biden campaign's main account. Combined with his affiliated committees, the Biden campaign had $117 million on hand to spend at the beginning of 2024, after raising $97 million in the final 3 months of 2023. Biden left Washington on Tuesday for California, where he will attend campaign fundraisers in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Los Altos Hills, California. In January, the Biden campaign had 422,000 unique donors make 502,000 contributions, according to the campaign. More than 1.1 million donors have contributed to the campaign overall. 97% of donations to the campaign have been $200 or less. Julie Chavez Rodriguez, Biden's campaign manager, called the campaign's January fundraising an indisputable show of strength to start the election year. While Team Biden-Harris continues to build on his fundraising machine, Republicans are divided, either spending money fighting Donald Trump or spending money in support of Donald Trump's extreme and losing agenda, she said. Either way, judging from their weak fundraising, they're already paying the political price. And Capital One is acquiring Discover in a $35 billion deal. The companies hope to rival top payments networks. Capital One is acquiring Discover Financial Services in an all-stock transaction valued at $35.3 billion, the company said Monday. Capital One shareholders will own 60% of the combined company, while Discover shareholders will own 40%. Capital One Chairman and CEO Richard Fairbank said the acquisition of Discover is a singular opportunity to bring together two very successful companies with complementary capabilities and franchises, and allows the newly combined company a chance to build a payments network that can compete with the largest payments networks and payments companies. According to the news release announcing the acquisition, Discover's payments network has 70 million merchant acceptance points in more than 200 countries and territories, making it the smallest of the four U.S.-based global payments networks, trailing Visa, MasterCard, and American Express. Capital One's acquisition adds scale and investment, enabling the Discover network to be more competitive with the largest payments networks and payments companies. The transaction is expected to close in late 2024 or early 2025, subject to, quote, satisfaction of customary closing conditions, including regulatory approvals and approval by shareholders of each company, Capital One said in the news release. Three Discover board members, to be named at a later date, will join the Capital One board of directors upon closing the deal. This agreement underscores the strength of our business and is a testament to the hard work of Discover employees, said Discover CEO and President Michael Rhodes. We look forward to a bright future as part of the Capital One family and to providing expanded opportunities for our loyal customers.
U.S. Air Force knows what failed in fatal 23 Osprey crash. An Air Force Special Operations Command said Tuesday it knows what failed on a CV-22B Osprey leading to a November crash in Japan that killed eight service members, but it still does not know why the failure happened. Because of the crash, hundreds of Osprey aircraft across the Air Force, Marine Corps, and Navy have been grounded since December 6th. There are two investigations looking into the Japan crash. A safety investigation board, which is a privileged internal review conducted in private to help inform the pilots and crew, as well as an accident investigation board, which is the official administrative review, and both are still ongoing. Separately, Air Force Special Operations Command is undertaking its own comprehensive review of its CV-22 Osprey program, and while the command has said it knows that it failed, it does not made any details public. At this time, the material failure that occurred is known, but the cause of the failure has not been determined. Engineering, testing, and analysis is ongoing to understand the cause of the material failure, a critical part of the investigation. Any disclosure of findings prior to investigations being finalized is premature and presumptive, Air Force Special Operations Command said in a statement released Tuesday. Air Force Special Operations Command was not available to comment on whether a gearbox chip caused the accident. However, it would not be the first time a chip issued was linked to the Air Force Special Operations Command Osprey mishap. In July of 2013, an Osprey experienced a prop rotor gearbox chip in flight. The sizes of the debris required the entire gearbox to be replaced. In January of 2014, an Osprey made a precautionary landing after another mid-flight gearbox chip, according to data obtained by the Associated Press. Chipping can cause by a variety of factors, including a lack of lubrication for the gears or the gear teeth being subject to forced overloads. The Osprey has a chip detector that triggers a warning to crews if the metal fragments are detected, alerting them that there are pieces of metal breaking off in the gears. The procedure is to land immediately, Bravoli said. Most chip warning lights are due to a very small piece of metal and are harmless, and the aircraft lands safely.